It's one of Australia's most baffling unsolved missing persons cases. In 2007, four people, including a five-year-old girl, vanished in Western Australia amid rumours of bizarre behaviour, cults and long-hidden secrets.
Yep, we're trying to track them down.
I'm Dominique Bayens and I've been investigating for the new season of Expanse, the Nan Up 4. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
As the jury was being told how Irma Palasics died, the pathologist in the witness box revealed a mistake and made a surprising admission about her autopsy reports. I'm Stephen Stockwell, and just a heads up, this episode contains some graphic descriptions. It's episode 4 of the case of the two intruders.
Irma Palasics' brutal murder rocked her family and has haunted them for 24 long years.
This wasn't the average robbery.
The brutality of the attack shocked the community.
They were virtually tortured that night.
Violently assaulted before the two men ransacked the premises and stole cash and jewellery.
My grandparents were beaten and my grandmother was left to die on the lounge room floor.
While we've only had a couple of days of evidence since our last episode, we have learnt quite a lot, from the injuries that Irma sustained to how milk is packaged and how often gloves were changed by the man investigating this crime scene. And Elizabeth Byrne, the ABC's Canberra court reporter, has been there for all of it. Hello, Liz.
Hi, Stocky.
Liz, can you take us through the last few days of evidence in 60 seconds or so?
Well, the case has been jumping around with the witnesses, as we already know, but the jury finally got to hear the results of the autopsy report, which was delivered by a doctor who wasn't there because the original one has since died. He was asked about the injuries Irma Palasics suffered and what may have caused her death. In a change of pace, the jury also got to hear from the manager of a milk processing plant, which not only supplied Canberra in 1999, but supplied the milk bottle in the Palasics fridge. And the lawyers still haven't finished with forensic investigator Clifton Frost. After days of questioning by Steve Fabrizi's lawyer, Sky Jerome, Mr. Facconi's lawyer has taken Mr. Frost to the wider investigation and the discovery of a mysterious white van.
Thank you, Liz. Look, very surprised to hear about this mysterious white van, but also from someone who used to package milk, which I guess speaks to the importance of a DNA profile found on the milk bottle in the fridge of the Palasics home. The Palasics home is a scene we've spoken so much about, you know, how Irma was found by her husband Gregor after the home invasion and robbery, bound on the floor with tape over her mouth. And we've now had the details of her autopsy report presented to the court. What has the jury heard about how she died?
Well, they've already had a bit of a picture from the forensic scientist. But with the autopsy, they've learned a whole lot more about the actual injuries. Mm. Now, she had suffered a lot of blunt force injuries, multiple blunt force injuries, and it was all over her body. And the most notable of those was her broken nose, which had caused blood to flow into her airways. And it's thought that that was one of the major contributors to her death. Mm. But there was no definitive answer about what the cause of death was.
Right. Okay. And I guess it's important to note as well that this evidence wasn't delivered by the doctor who did the autopsy of Irma Palasics in 1999, but he does sound like a very experienced doctor regardless. Oh, I mean, actually, are these guys doctors?
Yes, they are. It's kind of like silent witness rather than CSI.
Okay.
These are proper full-on pathologists. Mm-hmm. This is Dr. Johan Duflot, and he has been Canberra's autopsy specialist for a number of years now. He was very experienced even at the time, but he was a successor to another very well-known and experienced pathologist, Dr. Peter Herdson. He carried out the original autopsy, but only a few years after that, he died. And so there was no full report prepared. Now, Dr. Duflo, who's been doing autopsies since 1988, has now estimated that he's done between 7 and 10,000 autopsies in his career. So he was asked to prepare the autopsy report by the police only last year.
Right. Now, we've heard, Liz, throughout the trial that Gregor found Irma face down following the home invasion, and he'd rolled her over to check on her to see if she was okay, to see if she was alive, and that's when he discovered that she had passed away. The thing that surprised me about Professor Duflo's evidence was that when he prepared this kind of assessment on Irma, he'd assumed that she was on her back when he died, because that's what was shown in the photos. When did he realise that this was an incorrect assumption that he based his report on?
Well, I was surprised as well. He admitted that it was only a couple of days before he gave evidence that he realised she'd been in a different position. Mm. Now, of course, this provided a bit of fodder for some other people to ask questions. But the bottom line was that Irma still had airways full of blood and she had still died. So he thought that it probably wouldn't have changed his final analysis of the situation, except that it was a fairly glaring thing to have not known about right up until the point where he was talking to the jury.
Yeah, I had this realization, you know, as I was thinking about that and putting it in a bit of a timeline, that on this podcast, we would have talked about how Irma was, you know, died face down and was turned over by Gregor before Professor Duflo would have known this himself, which is...
Well, clearly he hasn't been listening.
You know, he could have learned a couple of days earlier. The other thing that I found really interesting about Professor Duflo's evidence was that he came across as really quite critical of the reports that he was relying on to compile this report, right?
Yes, he was. Now, you have to remember, he could only base his report on the autopsy pictures, and there were quite a few of those, and the crime scene pictures, which is how he made the mistake about how Irma was lying.
Mm.
And there was a short report from the original professor who looked at this, and he learned some things from that. But he said there was a lack of detail in what was provided. And he thought that if he had been doing that autopsy at that time, it wouldn't have been detailed enough for him. There were a whole lot of other tests. For instance, things like measuring each injury, looking at each injury through a microscope, and, toxicology reports for all sorts of things, although there was one toxicology report which showed that Irma had not been drinking. So there was a lot of things he said he would have liked to have seen done, which weren't done, and he said it wasn't as detailed as he would have hoped.
Yeah, right. I mean, Liz, in our last episode, we talked a lot about how defence barrister Sky Jerome, the barrister for Steve Fabrizi, had zeroed in on whether the forensic evidence gathering at the Plasix home was kind of best practice at the time, asking lots of questions to Clifton Frost about, you know, how all that was done. I imagine with a revelation like this from Professor Duflo, you know, she must have jumped on that as well.
Yes, she did. And she asked him about other possibilities. Could Irma have broken her nose falling onto a hard surface and explored other, you know, things that might have happened in the house that might have caused her injuries and what she suffered later. In the end, though, Professor Duflo said that he felt that even though there were gaps, that and even though there should have been more detail, even if he'd been able to do those tests, he probably wouldn't have been able to arrive at an actual cause of death anyway.
Right.
So in some ways, his, you know, criticism of his predecessor was a bit of a moot point.
Right. And where does this leave us with cause of death? What the jury has kind of landed on here? Is it basically inconclusive? He's not sure exactly how Irma died?
Yes, it is inconclusive. And Irma had of course, had her airways filled with blood, and that would have been one of the contributors. But she was also covered in injuries to, you know, to her chest, to her head, to her arms, her legs, quite serious injuries, which he said had come from blunt force trauma and showed every sign of interpersonal violence. So there was a combination of things, and that's what he's put her death down to, but he couldn't say one particular injury or other was the actual cause.
Yeah, thank you, Liz. Good to kind of get an idea of where this is, where this is all up to. Talking about all this, though, is really confronting. I mean, we're talking about a 72-year-old woman who was beaten and killed in her own home. But why do we need to get into this level of detail? Why does the jury need to hear all of this?
Well, there's a number of reasons, and one of them is, you know, two men have their liberty at stake. They've been accused of this murder. And also there's a family waiting to find out, you know, how did their grandmother and mother die? And, you know, they've waited a very long time. There's also the issue of practices in 1999 and practices now, and whether there are any gaps in that. You know, it's a serious business, the stakes are high, and that's why she has to be so detailed.
Yeah. And as well as, you know, kind of the detail we're going into, there's photos being shown to the jury as well. I imagine very confronting photos of an autopsy of a woman in her 70s. And, you know, how's Justice Mossop looking after the jury, looking after members of the public gallery during these kind of moments?
Well, those sorts of photos haven't been shown to the public gallery, so any family members or people like myself haven't been able to see them. The jury, each, you know, he's warned them about confronting images if they're coming up.
Yeah.
And so the jury's been looked after in that way. But it's been very difficult to see anything from the public gallery, and that has certainly protected the family.
Yeah, okay. Liz, moving on from talking through the autopsy, there was a really interesting change of pace during the evidence that was presented last week. We had someone from a milk factory, a guy called Ron Delavadova, who was called in as a witness. What was he in there for?
Well, I did wonder when he first popped up. He has a very long CV, and which he went into, but he was looking after a milk factory at Penrith in 1999, and he was called in to explain how the milk was packaged and sent on to Canberra. Now, he also brought with him a little film, which we all got to watch, and in that film it showed how the milk bottles in that factory were made in that factory, and they had a special mark on them, and they were filled with milk that had been delivered to the factory, and then they went through this whole process. I mean, we've all seen it in our sort of school TV programs of production lines, and the milk bottles were filled, and then there were milk bottle tops from another company used to put on the top. But basically what we saw was no one touched them through the whole process. Now, how we know that that bottle was a bottle from that factory was in the Palasik's fridge is that each one had a special mark and tying it to that factory. And in 1999, all of the milk that came to Canberra through Woolworths went through that factory. And that's how we know that bit of it. So we were shown no DNA from anybody there.
Okay, and the milk bottle is important, obviously, because that's where police say they have recovered a DNA profile, which they think is Steve Fabrizi's, which is what they say places him at that crime scene. And so, yeah, I guess this is their way of showing this DNA couldn't have ended up on the milk bottle as it was going through the factory. Is that right?
That's right. And it shuts off one avenue of contamination that Sky Jerome might have been able to explore. This one's now completely shut down.
Yeah, okay. It reminds me, Liz, a little bit of the trial of Aaron Patterson, actually. There was evidence given during that trial on the the processing of mushrooms that go to Woolworths, because Erin Patterson had said that she got the mushrooms for her poisoned beef Wellington from Woolworths. And so we heard about the lines that product moves in, and that you can't cultivate death cat mushrooms. So that wasn't something that had come through Woolworths. So hearing that and hearing this reminded me of that moment. How was Ron giving his evidence? I mean, you get these people that are very passionate about quite niche jobs. Did he go into a little bit more detail than we might have needed in the courtroom?
Possibly. He was very enthusiastic. He's now retired, so this was something that he'd had to cast his memory back on. But we got a little bit of a lesson in what sort of products were produced, and he, you know, yogurts and things like that. And I was very relieved to hear him say that milk bottled today is sent out today. So at least we know that in 1999, the milk was fresh.
Great. Okay, that is very good to know. And such a, you know, interesting range of the types of witnesses we get as well. You know, you have the autopsy of Erin Palasik, and then this little, you know, little palate cleanser almost of how milk is produced in the, you know, along the eastern states of Australia. Liz, Clifton Frost, we spent most of our previous episode talking about. He is the forensic investigator that was combing the Palasik's home. He still has a bit more cross-examination to go. And we've had sort of these witnesses coming in between some of his. Has he been back much over the last couple of days?
Yes, he has. And he'll be back again today.
Right.
Clifton Frost has been extensively examined by Sky Jerome, as we've already talked about. More recently, she moved on to day five of the examination of the house, which is when they removed the drinking vessels from the fridge and swabbed them. And so she went into a detailed series of questions about, well, where did you put the jug when you took it out of the fridge, and who touched it, and was everything swabbed, and all of that sort of information. But critically, we stopped at the swabs because we're yet to hear evidence about the allegation that Mr. Facconi's DNA was found on the water jug and Mr. Fabrizi's was found on the milk bottle. We sort of went over that in great detail. She also went into how the lab functioned, how it was cleaned, what risks of contamination there were. And then she got quite detailed in her line of questioning. And there was a point where Mr. Frost became a little bit frustrated, and he actually addressed the jury quite directly. And he said, the problem here is that we're trying to overlay techniques and practices of today on practices 26 years ago. So he was politely becoming a little bit frustrated over the length of questioning. Remember, we had a few days out of court, and he's had to come back after that. So he has been in the stand, or pending being in the stand, for quite a while.
Yeah, and I noticed we've had these witnesses being what's called interposed, kind of in, coming in between him and other points. Is that to give him a break? Or what's happening there?
No, that's a fairly usual practice, and that's because somebody like Professor Duflo is in high demand, and he can only come and give evidence on at a certain time. There's been some evidence by video link from like old neighbours and things like that, who some of them are overseas, and that, so they've been beamed in on a Zoom. So we've heard from them by video link. So basically, some witnesses they have to go to when they're available, and others are in the court.
Yeah, Clifton Frost, unfortunately, sitting in a room, probably just outside the court, actually, just in the hallway, waiting for his moment to come back in and continue his grilling from Sky Jerome, from the sounds of it. Has he had much of an opportunity outside of that kind of like point to the jury about how you're trying to work on these, you know, we're assessing practices of 25 years ago against standards of today? Has he tried to explain anything else about the way they'd worked through these times?
Well, he has pointed out that this is a problem several times, but he has tried to answer as many questions as he can in terms of what he remembered doing or what their practice was at the time. So he's phrased his answers in that way. And often Sky Jerome will say back to him, I'm not asking what you would have done, I'm asking what you did do. And he said, I'm trying very hard to remember, you know, things that happened 26 years ago.
Yeah, 26 years ago, an 8-day examination of a house, trying to remember what you were doing on day 5 and how you did that would be so challenging. I mean, I just think about how, you know, Sky Jerome focused so closely on the grey cart that was, you know, placed next to exhibits and potential contamination that could have been caused by that. You spoke a lot about that in our last episode. What else has she zeroed in on in her cross-examination in the last couple of days?
Well, she's done the same exercise. So we had the grey card. Could that have been contaminated? Was it sanitised? The answer was no, it probably wasn't. Yep. No, that wasn't best practice. She's done that with a number of other items that were in the house. Then she's also, there was a video taken of the crime scene. So she's also asked about photos or also in the video where items appear to have been moved within the crime scene. And she asked, what was that about? And Clifton Frost has explained how, as James talked about last time, the layers that they have to unpack in the within the crime scene in order to show what might be there, which might give them a clue. So that was one area she tried to explore, but really, that was easy for Clifton Frost to explain that, you know, really they were unpacking this crime scene as they went along.
Yeah, yeah. We mentioned very briefly that the police had a couple of dogs in their house. I mean, is Sky Jerome looking at ways to bring them into what's happened here?
Yes, even the dogs are in the frame. They were apparently hanging around the back door. It's a bit sad, really. But one of the questions she asked about that was, you know, the dogs being in the house in the first place and were samples of their hair or their fur, I should say, taken? And the answer to that was yes.
Oh, right.
The dog's fur was taken because they, you know, if they found it in the house, they'd be able to discount it. But there was also some issue about whether the dogs could have transferred DNA to that screen that had been taken from the window in the bathroom that was laying on the ground outside.
Yeah.
Clifton Frost said it was very unlikely that something like that would happen. But, you know, I suppose it's possible.
Yeah, and that's what Sky Jerome is, you know, trying to put in the jury's mind, these possibilities that could have occurred throughout the entire investigation. Liz, you mentioned a mysterious white van at the start of this episode. You're going to need to tell me more about this. What's happening there?
There's little that the jury has heard about this so far. I'm hoping today we'll hear more. Clifton Frost is now under cross-examination from Mr. Facconi's lawyer, Travis Jackson. And he opened with the big question, is this the biggest crime scene you ever dealt with? And the answer to that was yes. But Clifton Frost says the white van was just one of many vehicles that they had to go and investigate. So this was a huge investigation. It wasn't just the scene. And this is where this line of questioning takes us away from the house and to the wider investigation. Now, the white van's important because in the back of it or inside the white van, they found a roll of tape with blood on it.
Oh.
But the line of questioning has shown that there was some issue with contamination and lots of meetings. All I can say about that is to be continued.
Okay. Well, look, there's still plenty to go and I look forward to hearing more about the mysterious white van in our next episode, if more is told to the jury. I mean, Liz, we are now into week 4 of a trial that was expected to run for 3 to 6 weeks. Any idea how much longer we've got to go?
Well, the lawyers were asked to come up with a time frame by the judge who'd been asked by the jury. I don't know if that means they're getting sick of the case or not, but the judges told them that probably another 3 or 4 weeks.
Right.
But that doesn't include deliberation time. So we're looking at still quite a while before we get to the end of this trial.
Yeah. Okay. Still a lot to cover as well. I mean, we're, you know, the prosecution laid out these kind of planks of the investigation and the way they present the evidence. We're up to plank 5 at the moment, which is the crime scene, and yet to get into kind of some of the DNA evidence, the investigations into what had happened after that. And yeah, plenty more to come. So we'll keep going with the case of the two intruders and keep you up to date with everything that's happening. Liz, there's plenty of people that are very interested in this trial as well. We're getting lots of questions through to the case of at abc.net.au. One here from Lauren that I want to start with because she's listening to the pod on ABC Listen. So thank you, Lauren, for getting around ABC Listen. Lauren does have a few questions, some of which we can't get to yet, so I've filed them away for after the trial. But I was really interested in this one, Liz. Lauren asks, did Mr. Palasics recognise either of the men who stood trial or a standing trial at the moment, Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Ficconi?
Well, the evidence suggests he didn't. He didn't know who they were. He did give a description of people, where two men wearing balaclavas, and one of them attacked him and he thought the other one had attacked his wife, who he later found dead in the hallway. But no, he didn't recognise them.
Yeah, and Mr. Palasics hasn't been in the courtroom to look at them or assess them in any way, has he?
No, of course not, because he died some time ago. And all we know from him is that first-hand interview that he gave to police while he was lying in his hospital bed, still suffering from the injuries he received himself in the hours after the attack.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Liz. Wonderful question as well, Lauren. So thank you for writing into the case of at abc.net.au. Liz, another one here from Alicia, who's listening from Canberra. She says, it seems the intruders were aware of the money hidden under the oven. Is there any indication of how they might have known? For example, was the safe or hiding spot installed by an external company?
No, it wasn't. It was installed by family members. In fact, there are two sort of versions of this, but one of them is that their son-in-law, who they had a kitchen business, basically, and they, by the time this happened, they'd retired and their son-in-law was running the business. And so he got them a new kitchen because the house wasn't in very good state when they moved into it. And then in the course of the evidence, their daughter, who's married to that son-in-law, said to the court that her son had in fact installed most of the kitchen and the secret hiding place. So it wasn't strangers, it was family members.
Yeah. Got it. Thank you, Liz. And Alicia, great question. Appreciate you writing into the pod. And the last one here, Liz, from Bella, who's been listening intently. And Bella notes that the court's heard that of the two intruders, one was with Gregor and one was with Irma. And Bella's wondering how two people can be charged with murder. Can both be found guilty of murder, or is it only possible for one person to be found guilty in the end?
Well, as many previous cases have shown, if you're there and someone you're with murders someone and you've gone there to commit a crime, which might lead to the death of someone, then you get the same penalty as them. So that is not an unusual thing at all. There are lots of precedents. Sometimes they call it murder by joint commission. There has to be some kind of agreement. But if there is an agreement, you don't have to have an agreement to murder someone. But if you've agreed to go and do a crime and someone gets murdered, then you have to take the rap as well.
Thank you, Liz. Thank you, Bella, for writing into the case of at abc.net.au. If you have any questions yourself, something you'd like us to answer on the pod, please get in touch. The case of at abc.net.au is our email address, and we do read every single one that comes through. So if you have anything you'd like to know, any reflections, anything you think we'd find interesting, please get in touch. Liz, where are we going next in this trial?
Well, today will be more questioning from Travis Jackson, Mr. Ficconi's lawyer, to Clifton Frost. Hopefully that will be the last for Clifton Frost. and then he can be free. I don't know quite where we're going after this, but I'm looking forward to the DNA evidence and, more importantly, the police investigation evidence, which came much later in the piece because it was an undercover operation.
Yeah, really interesting stuff coming up in the trial, and we'll keep you up to date here on the case of the two intruders. We'll be back in your feed on Thursday. The Case of the Two Intruders is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by Elizabeth Byrne and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. This episode was produced on the land of the Ngunnawal, Ngambri and Wurundjeri people.